Good morning, everyone. Like Richard said, my name is Oliver Friedrichs, formerly with Symantec, and I'm here today to talk about some of the research that we did over the past year looking into the presidential election. Now, the research that we did actually applies to not only this election, but to really any political campaign, whether it's in the United States or in other countries around the world. So the research we did also was done in conjunction with a book called Crimeware that was published by Symantec Press. So instead of having to buy the book, I'll actually tell you everything that's in at least one chapter of the book. But there's actually a few other really good chapters in that book by other contributors outside of Symantec, such as the Google guys, talking about click fraud and a variety of other things. Okay, so one thing we need to look at when we're looking at the election is that this is kind of a different type of research project, right? So it's not the traditional style of research that you would see at Black Hat, where it's a new vulnerability or an exploit or a flaw in a hardware or software application. This is really a different type of exercise where we're really trying to apply a research method to the election process and try to identify, you know, what can an attacker actually do if they were to try to subvert or affect an election. So when we look at this, we're really trying to to look at a number of things. One is that we can certainly speculate on what attackers could do. We can look at the past and identify what attackers have done in the past. And we could also make guesses as to what we think would happen given our many decades of experience in the security space and everything that we've seen over the last few years. So a lot of what we're going to talk about has really been talked about before. You know, there's not that much that's new today when we look at security, but there's really new ways to apply attacks to things like the electoral system. And we really want to try to apply fact to this and make sure that we're balancing what we're saying. You know, we're not trying to spread FUD. And it's amazing when you actually try to go looking for pictures for your presentation that you can find products named FUD that look like some kind of a lunch meat in Europe or Greece. Doesn't look very good, though. So when we look at the attacks that we're going to talk about, we're really trying to rank them in three different ways. The first is an elevated threat. This is something that is not an immediate threat, but it's something that can be used as a stepping stone or something that can lead to a further risk or further threat in the future. The second type of rating that we apply to the threats that we're looking at is really high. This is something that's very serious, something that you should be really concerned about, and something that could compromise the integrity of a candidate's campaign or of voters in general. And then finally, extreme. This is an attack that is very, very serious. It has widespread implications, and it causes immediate decrease in confidence amongst voters and candidates that are in the running in a particular election. So when we look at the internet and how it's affected by the election process, we've really seen a dramatic increase in how widespread and how frequently the internet is used today throughout the course of an election. And it's really grown since starting around 2004, the last presidential election, when we first saw the internet used on a fairly widespread basis. So it's really important to understand what attackers could do if they were to actually try to subvert or influence an election, whether it's attacking the candidates themselves, the process, the electoral system, or the voters. So we really need to look at existing threats like adware, spyware, malicious code, typo squatting, and these are some of the things that we looked at, and we were able to come up with some really unique ways that they can be applied to the election itself. And our emphasis here is on the 08 election, like I said, but really these types of attacks could be applied to any election. And surprisingly, we haven't seen a lot of widespread attacks yet throughout the course of this election. In fact, there's been suspiciously few attacks over the last year or so since candidates have been in the running. So let's look at how the internet has grown in terms of its use throughout the course of an election. It was really used for the first time heavily in 2004, primarily by the Kerry campaign. So they were by far the most prolific when it came to using the internet during the 2004 election. John Kerry raised $82 million online during that election. Howard Dean raised $20 million, and George Bush raised $14 million. So you can see that the amount of money we're talking about here is not pocket change. You know, this is a lot of money, and there's a lot of money to be gained if you're to try to attack, for example, the online donation process or the online donation systems. Now, when we look at how the internet is used by donors, and voters, it's increasingly being used for online donations. And if you make a donation, for example, they found that 45% of Democrat donors received email daily from their campaigns. And 70% of online donors forwarded email that they received for a particular campaign to other people, which tells us that there's really a viral nature in terms of emails being spread once a candidate or once a voter receives an email from a particular candidate. And also the interesting thing is that most of the donations that are being made online are very, very small. They're generally under $200, but there's a lot of them. So there's a lot of donations that are being made in order to accrue this much money. So needless to say, there's a lot of money at stake today, and it's certainly something that criminals really haven't recognized yet. So it's likely something that we're going to see in the future. If you look at the 2008 election, it is quite different. We see that the Obama campaign has raised close to $350 million already throughout the course of this election. And we have some numbers in terms of how much they've raised online, and it's roughly around 80 to 90% per month of all donations are being raised online. In January, for example, Barack Obama raised $28 million online. And in February, $45 million online. So that's, again, not pocket change. That's a lot of money. And if again, we look at the other donations throughout March, April, May, and June, we can see that there's still a lot of money being raised, although we didn't have the online numbers for those months. So one threat that we're going to talk about is typo squatting. Now, I'm hoping that most of you know what typo squatting is already. It's really registering a domain that's a typo of an existing domain. So for example, instead of barackobama.com, someone registers Barack Obama with two A's instead of one A. It's very, very prevalent and very, very common. So really we took a look at typo squatting and how it can be applied to the electoral system and to the current campaigns in the running for the 08 election. Now, first, some background on typo squatting. When we look at typo squatting, it's been around for a long time. People have been registering domain names that are typos or variations or even trademark names for legitimate organizations since the early 90s, really since commerce started on the internet. And it was very, very common for people to register a domain name and then sell it to the actual trademark owner or the company to make money from it. A lot of people made a lot of money doing that. That was until people actually had a vehicle to get their domain name back. And that was really the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Policy that was issued or passed by ICANN in 1999. And this is a method by which if you're a legitimate domain name owner and someone's infringing on your trademark, you can go to WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, and you can get your domain name back. So it's an arbitration board. They look at your case. And in most cases, if you're the trademark owner, they'll side in your favor and you'll get your domain name back. So the great thing about this is, well, hey, you can get your domain name back after someone's already stolen it. Well, it doesn't really help you, does it? So, you know, there's still an issue with this in that there's really no way that the registrars today are preventing people from still registering those domain names, but at least there's a way for you to get it back afterwards. Now, another thing that took effect in 99 was the ACPA, which is the Anti-Cyber Squatting Protection Act, and this is a legal remedy in the U.S. to get your domain name back. And the good thing about this is that it allows you to get your domain name back and also get back financial loss if someone has been infringing and profiting from your domain name. Whereas the UDRP is really just a way for you to get your domain name back, the ACPA actually lets you file a civil suit and get any money back that was profited from someone owning your domain name as well as legal costs and other costs. So again, the great thing about this is that, well, it doesn't help. People still infringe, and it's really running rampant. There are millions and millions of domain names registered in bad faith that are not owned by their legitimate trademark owners or that are typos of existing domain names. So this guy, everyone wants to be this guy, Kevin Ham. This guy made $300 million by registering typo domain names and speculating on domain names. That's a lot of money. So you wonder why this is so common. It's because of guys like this that have really made a business out of this. And, you know, for the most part, he's probably done it legitimately in many cases by registering domain names and selling them. But not in all cases, people are still using typo domains, which are in violation of trademarks for or common law names of individuals or companies. So let's look at some example cases. In this particular case, Julia Roberts, juliaroberts.com, was a domain name, which is a common name. She didn't have it trademarked, but it was a domain name owned by another individual. In this case, that's probably pretty hard to read, but Russell Boyd owned this domain name. So she went to WIPO and tried to get her domain name back. And so she filed a case with the arbitration committee. They actually filed in her favor, and they gave her domain name back. And you can see she's pretty happy, and she got her domain name back. Now, Sting, on the other hand, owns Sting.com. So Sting.com is pretty general, right? It's not really a common name, although it's the name that he uses. His real name is Gordon Sumner. And in this case, Michael Irvin, one of those. I don't actually know his name. But he filed a case with WIPO to get his domain name back. And in this case, they did not rule in his favor, simply because it was just such a generic name, so it wasn't really something that they could side with him on. And you can see he's still playing his guitar, and he's not particularly happy. So one thing that we did is we looked at all of the current candidates. We looked at all of the candidates that were in the running in the 2008 election, and we started out by looking at the Federal Election Commission website and identifying all of the candidates who had filed to run in the election. We found 19 candidates, and we identified all of their primary websites, all the domain names that they owned on the internet, and we removed anything that was not .com. And the only reason we did that is that we had access to the VeriSign zone data, the root zone data, which allowed us to easily find domain names and do these lookups. So that left us with about 17 domain names that we were able to do an analysis on. And these are the domain names. You know, everything that you'd suspect, these are all the candidates that were in the election up until recently. And we were able to find all their domain names and confirm that these were, in fact, their real domain names. You can see in some cases they're the full name of the candidate. In other cases, they're the candidate's name plus the year. So there's really no standard. There's a variety of different domain names that they've picked. So we really did two tests. One test is that we did an analysis of how many typo domains were already registered for all of these candidates. Secondly, we did an analysis of cousin domains. So those are domains like voteforhillaryclinton.com. And there can be millions of those domain names. So quite honestly, we didn't really look at all of them because it was going to be impossible to really find them all. So we just looked at typos that you would make when you're typing in an address into the address bar and you'd go to the wrong website. So we created two simple applications, TypoGen, which generates the typos, and then TypoLookup, which actually looks up the typos via DNS and Whois to see who owns the domain names. And we looked for around 5 common typo mistakes. So the first one is really forgetting the dot between the www and the mittromney.com. So very, very common, and you'll find that in many cases these typos are registered by people other than the real website. Missing characters, so for example, Mitt Romney without 2 T's. Surrounding characters, so if you look at your keyboard, beside the A key is the S key, right? So it's very easy to make that mistake. Additional characters that were added, so hitting a second character twice by accident, so that's very common as well. And then finally, reversing 2 characters, so instead of Mitt Romney, you've got Imp Romney. So these are the variations that we looked at, and for any domain name, if you walk through every single one of these letters, there's literally 100 or more possible typos. So there's a lot of domain names to register. So this is really what we found. And this is actually back in August of last year when we started this analysis. We found that Barack Obama was by far the most typo squatted. So we looked at all of the domain names that were registered typos and that were not owned by Barack Obama, for example. And they are all owned in bad faith. In many cases, they had advertising on their site, or they had something else. And the something else could be a variety of things. So in this case, we found that 52 out of 160 of Barack Obama's domain names were already owned by other people acting in bad faith. They were not owned by Barack Obama's campaign. Hillary Clinton, 30% of her domain names were owned by someone else other than her. John Edwards, 34 out of 170. So you can see that really as the popularity of candidates go down, the likelihood that they're going to be typo squatted also goes down, right? Not rocket science. It's pretty much how typo squatters work. They're able to register domain names, and there's a technique called tasting, where they'll register a domain name for 5 or 6 days, and they can actually return it back to the registrar without paying for it. So it's very, very easy for them to register a domain name, see how much traffic they get, and then dump it afterwards, so that they can only get traffic for the most frequently visited typos. Now, when we looked at this again in February, we found that things had changed a little bit. In this case, Hillary was beating Barack in terms of typo squatting, which obviously doesn't reflect the current situation. But Hillary was at around 41% in terms of the number of domain names, typo domain names, out of the total number that were currently being infringed on, whereas Barack Obama was around 29%. So you can again see that the numbers have changed a little bit, but there's still a lot of people registering typo domains. You can also see that in some cases, some of these websites for candidates who aren't even in the race anymore are still accepting donations. In some cases, it's not clear why they're accepting donations. So in the case of John Edwards or Ron Paul, you know, they allow donations, but there's really no indication of where the money goes. Right? They're not even telling you that they're using it to recover debt. You know, in the case of some of these websites, they'll actually tell you, hey, we have a lot of debt. We want to take some more donations. We want to help pay off that debt. In other cases, websites have just been abandoned. This was actually shocking to me that a candidate would just abandon their website entirely and not even keep the domain registered in some cases. So that was really interesting. But needless to say, you know, the candidates are still heavily typo squatted even this year. But here's a couple examples where websites have been abandoned. On Joe Biden's website, for example, you can still kind of make a donation, but the merchant account was disabled, so it gives you a warning saying that it's actually there's an error. So interesting, you know, if I actually tried to make a donation, but a little confusing. So it really, we can see that campaigns aren't doing a good job of cleaning up their websites after they drop out of the race. In other cases, like in the case of Tommy Thompson, you know, the website's actually shut down. You know, we're not sure what's really there. It's kind of an error page. In the case of Sam Brownback, well, the domain name expired, and it got bought by a typo squatter or someone who bought the domain and is hosting ads on it now. Right? So you can see advertisements on the domain, but clearly it's still not owned by Sam Brownback. In Jim Gilmore's case, the site's disabled, the account's been shut down, and you know, it's you get another error message saying that it's been suspended. And this has been up there for about 6 months now. So pretty interesting to see, you know, how candidates handle their campaigns after they decide to drop out. Well, let's look at some examples. And this is where, you know, we can find a few interesting things happening. So BarackObama.com is a typo of BarackObama.com. And it's owned by a typo squatter. In this case, it is actually hosting advertisements for the real Barack Obama campaign. So the interesting thing about this is that Barack Obama is paying to host advertisements, in this case through Google, and the typo squatter is hosting the advertisements on a typo domain. So what's happening is that Barack Obama's campaign is paying for advertisements. The typo squatter is getting paid by Google for hosting advertisements on a domain name that the Obama campaign should really own in the first place. So it's interesting how online advertising and syndication is playing into this, because you know, we can clearly see that, you know, there's some interesting things happening when we look at the advertising space. And campaigns are spending a lot on advertising today, in some cases many millions of dollars for online advertising. So some of this money is clearly being misspent and going to typo squatters when the campaigns should really be owning these domain names. So in this case, another typo of Hillary Clinton, HillaryKlingon.com. Right, so, you know, there's all kinds of stuff up here that we can see that that people are registering. So in many cases, websites that detract from the candidate, and you know, these things are pretty funny. Join Rudy 20008.com if he's going to be running then, just in case. And this is a website that detracted from him. Today, I don't think there's anything up here anymore, or there might be something different. But during the when he was still in the running, this was a site that detracted from his campaign. So if you typed two zeros instead of one, you'd end up at this site. MuttRomney.com, which talks about him killing small animals as a teen. So interesting. And, you know, these are all typos. So the U key is right beside the I key on your keyboard, right? So it's very easy to type this in and to end up here. And then JillaryClinton.com. This is interesting because it's hosting ads for BarackObama.com, right? So this is, again, a situation where advertising and the purchasing of keywords plays into this based on, you know, context-sensitive search and the ability to buy keywords. You know, we haven't seen a lot of this, to be honest with you, but it'll be interesting to see in future elections and even later in this election how this plays out and how frequently your campaigns use things like the advertising model to advocate for themselves. Okay, so you know, we saw all these typos, and we looked at all of the typo squatters and everyone who was currently typo squatting the candidates, and we thought, hey, you know, these guys are doing it. We really want to do it too. So we actually registered 124 typo domains to protect them. It cost us $800 on GoDaddy, so it was really, really easy to do this. And these are the domain names we registered. This was, again, last August, so we weren't really sure, you know, who to register. We didn't really want to register everyone, you know, because we didn't quite want to spend that much money on it for the research project. So we registered Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, and Hillary Clinton, and we registered every typo that was not already registered by others. So the interesting thing was that we've owned these domain names since July 2007. Not one person has contacted me asking me, hey, what are you doing? Why do you have these domain names? Now, it's pretty clear that if you look at the actual registration data or in Whois, you know, my name's there, semantics address is there, and it clearly says registered to prevent typo squatting. So we can see that, you know, if anyone were to look at this, you know, they would clearly see that, hey, you know, these guys are doing it to protect the campaign, and we're actually, in many cases, we've transferred these domain names to the campaigns themselves over time. But initially, nobody had really questioned, you know, why these domain names were owned by myself. So these domain names sat idle for about 6 months during the end of 2007. One thing that we did then is we thought, hey, we have all these domain names. Let's actually see what we can do with them. So we registered, we had these domain names registered. We set up Apache using virtual domains, and we forwarded all of these domain names to our own server, running Linux, running Apache with virtual domains. And when you went to one of these typo domains, you'd actually be redirected to the real website. So if you went to Barack Obama with two A's, which we had, you would actually end up at Barack Obama's website. And we were just interested in seeing, you know, who was coming to these typo domains so we could do some more analysis. So we collected a lot of log data for about 2 months between January and March. We used a free product called Weblog Expert, which was actually really good in order to analyze the logs that we collected, which were pretty standard Apache log files. And you know, we had a limited amount of data. We had only about 2 months worth of data, but it was still pretty interesting. So this is really what we found. We found that there were 21,000 hits to our 124 domains, and we saw around 351 hits a day. So these were users that were mistyping one of these three candidates' websites and coming to our server instead. And on average, we saw, you know, 2.57 hits per visitor. And in total, over 2 months, around 8,300 visitors came to our typo domains that we owned, and then we'd send them back to the real site. So, you know, not a ton of traffic, but still, if I'm an attacker, there's some interesting things I can do with this traffic, right? If they're coming to my website, I have a lot of options. So let's look at the actual stats. Really interesting to see that we saw a spike of people coming to our typo domains on days like Super Tuesday in February, when, you know, the primaries, not the primaries, the caucuses were happening. And that's when people were more likely to go to candidates' websites, and they were more likely to go to either Barack Obama's website, Mitt Romney's website, or Hillary Clinton's website, you know, the typos that we owned, and then come through our server so we could see, you know, who was coming to our website. So we can see a clear spike there during the various caucuses throughout the February and March timeframe. We also looked at which were the most common mistyped domain names. You know, what was the most frequently typoed domain name among the ones that we owned? And we didn't own all of them, so we could just look at the ones that we actually had. And we found that Barack Obama with two A's was actually the most frequently mistyped domain name. And then Barack Obama with two A's in the beginning was also mistyped. So again, it's not clear if people don't know how to spell it or if they're just actually mistyping it by hitting the same key twice. Yeah, that's not something that we can really determine through this, but it was still interesting that, you know, these were the most frequently mistyped domain names. And Barack Obama with two A's got about 950 visitors and about 1,700 hits throughout that time frame. So we were able to look at which countries these typo squad or the actual voters were coming from, who were coming to our typo squatted domain names. We could see that the U.S. was by far the largest originating country, Canada second. But interesting, when you look at number three, United Arab Emirates is number three in terms of the source of typo users who are entering typos within their address bar. And we'll actually get into that a little bit later, because I was really curious why that was happening. And it's you kind of put your conspiracy theory hat, but it turns out that it's not actually what you think it is. It's actually kind of strange what was happening there. So we were able to look at where the typo users were coming from by city and state. California was the most frequent source by state. San Diego was the most frequent source by city. And again, this could be a factor of where the ISPs are registered in many cases, where the net blocks that are owned by the actual users are coming from. But it still kind of represents, you know, where we think the source of these typo users are coming from. So it's still an interesting number to look at. We're also able to see which browsers users are running as they come to our website. So interesting to see IE7 is the most frequent browser. IE6 is still very, very high on the list, though, and Firefox is a close third. So we can see that there's still a lot of IE6 out there when we look at users that are coming to our typo domain names. Interesting. All right, so what can I do with that? Well, you know, we see a lot of browser plugin vulnerabilities. Right, no secret. We saw close to 500 browser plugin vulnerabilities throughout 2007. Right, so again, if I'm an attacker and I want to attack voters or supporters of a particular campaign, I could have easily tried to put malware on my site or put a phishing website up on my typo domain names. Then we were able to look at OS, what OS these users are running. This is part of the part of the standard HTTP GET request that is in every log file. So this is not rocket science. It's very, very easy to get and pretty obvious. So we can see Windows XP is by far the most common OS run by users who are entering typos and coming to our typo domains. So why was United Arab Emirates third on our list? Well, again, we thought that was really suspicious, so we wanted to look at it. Interesting, you know, there's one IP address that all of these visits were coming from. And we saw 183 visitors from this one address and about 208 hits from that address. So it's likely behind a NAT device, either countrywide or potentially hosted by an ISP. And we can see that the NAT block is actually owned by Emirates Telecommunications Corporation. So let's look at what we actually saw. And we looked at the actual log lines because, funny enough, they're actually all the same. So in this case, every single one of these hits was to BarackObama.com with two O's. And we saw about 59 hits over 15 days, you know, a few every single day, and that just seemed really weird. Why was someone coming to our typo domain that we owned every single day trying to go to Barack Obama's website with this type of a spelling? So we looked at the log file, and it had this in it. It had something called Simbar enabled, which was kind of interesting. I wasn't able to find too much on it, but you know, Google search showed up that it was a piece of adware called Simple Toolbar Search. And it didn't seem to be very common at all. In fact, you know, many of the major AV vendors didn't really seem to have a lot of information on it. But you know, I was able to find some of it. The interesting thing was that, you know, why was this piece of adware coming to our typo domain? You know, why would they possibly want to come to our domain? So the only thing we could really come up with was that they probably made a typo when they seeded their AdWare application, and they were really trying to go to BarackObama.com, and instead were coming to our typo domain. And this went away again after about 15 days, so it didn't last very long, but it was still really strange. Okay, so this is where it gets a little more interesting. in that when you have a typo domain, there's a ton of things you can do with it. You can redirect web traffic, right, which is pretty obvious, but you can also redirect email traffic, right? So instead of just redirecting www.domainname, you can redirect email. You can set up MX records for a domain, and you can intercept email for a particular campaign, or for really anyone. And this is a serious problem that really expands not only to the campaign, but really any company or any domain name owner. So if you own a domain name today, you'll be very, very careful and look at the typos on your domain name. So really how this works is that it's very, very simple. Every domain name has MX records that tell the mail sender where email should go to, right? Pretty clear. It's all part of DNS, which is we all know is very secure. And generally, MX records point to the legitimate domain. But in this case, when we own a typo domain, we can potentially redirect MX records to our own domain as well. So we did a very strictly controlled experiment. We weren't interested at all in actually intercepting email. So we didn't want to put ourselves in that position, but we were really interested to see what would happen if someone did try to intercept email using these 124 domain names that we had registered. So what we did is we set up a Linux system with IP tables blocking port 25 and just logging every single line. And then we redirected all 124 domain names of their MX records to our server. So what this allowed us to do is to actually see incoming requests for all of these domain names that were trying to send mail to a typo domain. So just like if you're trying to browse to a typo domain, well, it's really easy to send email to a typo domain as well. So we redirected 124 domains. We did it for only about 24 hours. Again, we really didn't want to disrupt any email for campaigns or even expose ourselves to seeing email or even the subject lines of email. So we really stopped at blocking the packets outright when they tried to hit our firewall system. So the interesting thing that we saw is we saw a total of 1,121 connection attempts over 24 hours. So this was 1,100 attempts of people trying to send email to either BarackObama.com, HillaryClinton.com, or MittRomney.com. Right? Interesting. Now, most of these emails came from 12 distinct IP addresses and around 7 top-level domains. They came from Yahoo.com, Google.com, Hotmail.com, and the 4 others which aren't as common. But really the interesting thing here is that these are emails intended for the actual campaign website or the campaign mail server, which were entered incorrectly and ultimately could have easily been intercepted. So you could easily set up SMTP sync, freely available open source application and really see what these emails would have been. And it's interesting to think about what could you have intercepted? Well, potentially a lot of sensitive things. Emails for the candidates, organizational emails, requests for information, internal campaign contributions from supporters. Campaigns have widespread support networks around the country that are all helping them in communicating through email today. Right, so a lot of this is happening through email. So even more scary, when we thought about this, we thought, what other types of companies could be affected by this? And we really wanted to come up with some examples that would kind of hit the message and send it home. And in this case, we looked at a few defense contractors. And we thought, which defense contractors would have MX records for their typo domains that looked suspicious? So the good thing is that these are now resolved, so these aren't actually legitimate concerns anymore. But in this case, we saw a typo domain for a well-known defense contractor pointing to India. Very interesting. But more scary was that in this case, we saw another defense contractor who had typo domain names registered pointing to China. So very interesting. And the interesting thing about this, too, was that there was absolutely no website. There was no website and no other DNS record registered for this domain. There is only an MX record. OK, Okay, so really, you know, when we look again at typo squatting, it can be a serious problem. You know, it doesn't sound very serious, but when you look at the potential to intercept web traffic and to intercept email, it really does start to get a little more serious than you would normally think. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about phishing, because phishing, again, is something that can really play a role in the outcome of an electoral campaign and throughout the course of an election. So we've seen a lot of event-based, profit-motivated phishing in the past. We've seen this many, many times. We see 1,000 phishing events on average every single day, 1,000 phishing campaigns for an individual brand. We also see event-based phishing very, very frequently. We saw it in 2004 around the Indian Ocean tsunami. So we see it very often around catastrophes and national disasters. So during Hurricane Katrina, again, we saw a lot of phishing. And we also see it around sporting events, like the FIFA World Cup in 2006. And we've even seen some already for the 2010 FIFA World Cup. So we see a lot of event-based phishing happening on a regular basis. Brazil sees, funny enough, very short-lived event-based phishing. So they'll see it for like rock concerts and other things that are very, very short-lived, but that are still very popular, and they clearly have enough victims that still fall for these types of attacks in order to make it worth their time. So one thing we did is we wanted to see, you know, how frequently were campaigns actually using email in order to communicate with voters. So we registered for every single campaign's email list for the course of around 8 months from August to April. And we received around 1,040 different emails during that period of time from all of these various campaigns. So by far the most frequent emails were from Barack Obama's campaign. Second was John Edwards, and third was Hillary Clinton. So from Barack Obama's campaign, we received around 128 unique emails during these 8 months. Now, the interesting thing is that there's only 17 candidates, but we saw around 174 unique email addresses coming from these candidates, so which was really interesting because they weren't very consistent, and they really didn't use consistent email practices. So these email addresses were pretty much all over the place when we saw them come in. Some examples of that: in the case of John McCain's campaign, the domain names actually changed, and we saw some domain names that we didn't recognize. In one case, we received an email from McCain08HQ.com, which was something that we really hadn't seen before. It wasn't his real campaign website. It was something that was somewhat suspicious. So again, if you're trying to inspire confidence in voters when you're communicating with them, you really want to be consistent here and try to use the same email address when you're sending your emails. Now, even worse, from Hillary Clinton, we saw well over a dozen different emails coming from her campaign. In fact, she probably has 3 or 4 email addresses herself that are sending us email. And quite honestly, I really don't know who many of these people are, but they're sending me email after I registered for her campaign mailing list. So again, the issue here is really, this is a somewhat moderate threat. It's not really a risk, but combined with phishing, it really adds confusion because it makes it unclear what in fact a legitimate email should look like coming from a campaign and what a phishing email would normally look like. Now, one thing we looked at was how frequently candidates were actually using sender ID and SPF to assign and to protect the list of servers that can actually send email from their domain names. So sender ID is a framework. If you're not familiar with it, it's more heavily used today than it has been in the past, but it allows you to essentially tell a receiving mail server a list of addresses that should be allowed to send mail from your domain name. So for example, if I'm barackobama.com, I can tell your mail server through a DNS record, through a TXT record, what the legitimate net blocks are that are allowed to send email for barackobama.com. So we looked at all of the existing candidates' domains, and we looked at whether or not they were using SPF. In many cases, they were. They were using SPF. At least the top candidates were. But some of the lower candidates definitely weren't. And we could see that in many cases, they just didn't really bother to set up a an SPF record. Now, some example of SPF records. This is a valid SPF record, right? So for Hillary Clinton's domain name, this tells you that, you know, this set of IP addresses is allowed to send email on behalf of HillaryClinton.com. You know, this is what you want to see. This is a good, valid SPF record. It also gives me some interesting information. I can see that she's using MX Logic and Postini for spam and malware filtering, right? So interesting to see. I can do a little bit of information gathering to see what she's using. Also, you know, when we look at other candidates, we can see that in some cases, like Tommy2008.com, you know, the SPF record that is set there is actually really, really bad. You know, that is not what you want for an SPF record. And the reason for that is that this record allows anyone to send email on behalf of Tommy2008.com, right? Not good. Not good if you're trying to actually protect who can spoof your email. Now, another thing we did is we looked at the websites of candidates, and we really wanted to look at what their donation websites looked like. You know, were they taking adequate precautions to actually protect their websites, and to, you know, apply common sense in terms of how they are capturing donations. Now, all candidates in this election are accepting donations online. So it's very, very common today, not only for political elections, but for, you know, many different purposes to accept donations online. So in all cases, we found that candidates were, in fact, using SSL, right? Not surprising. I'd be shocked if nobody was using SSL. But the funny thing was that in some cases, when you clicked on a donation link, you're actually sent to a completely different domain. So in the case of Cox2008.com, for example, you'd be sent to CompleteCampaigns.com, you know, which is a different domain name. It may add confusion, right, if I'm trying to determine whether or not that's really his website. And there's really no excuse for this, because this is just common sense DNS. Really, it's a matter of just setting the right subdomain or the right host name to point to this domain name. So it's somewhat surprising that, you know, campaigns really haven't followed that best practice. Now, the other thing that's interesting when we look at phishing is that donation websites and forms are very, very simple. So they're very, very simple. They've been made simple. They're one page. Right? So you enter all of your information on one single page. The credit card number, your name, how much you want to donate. You click submit, and you get an immediate verification of whether or not your donation was actually made. So we've seen phishing in the past. We saw it during the 2004 election. You know, it's been a high severity threat. You know, phishing is very, very common. Funny enough, we haven't seen a lot of it in this election, and we really don't know why. You know, we think maybe attackers are afraid to attack the political campaigns because of the implications or the repercussions from law enforcement. So that could definitely be one of them. But we have seen it in the past. For example, in 2004, we saw the Kerry Edwards campaign targeted, and we saw two major phishing attacks during that time frame. One asked voters to call a 1-900 number, which charged them $1.99 when they made the call. And another one actually just brought them to a typical phishing website, which tried to process your credit card number and steal your information. Today, like I said, we see over 1,000 phishing attacks per day. You know, that's a number that's pretty frequently quoted. So there's still a lot of phishing going on. Now, this is a somewhat unique attack, something that can be applied to the campaign websites themselves. And again, some of these attacks are somewhat new, simply because we haven't really seen them before. But they're also not very sophisticated. You know, some of these things are very, very easy for an attacker to implement. In this case, this attack allows, or would allow, an attacker to essentially divert campaign contributions. So one thing that, you know, we've kind of talked about is we've talked about typo domain names, we've talked about typo squatting, we've talked about phishing websites. Right, these are all ways that I can get a voter to come to my website. Now, if I were an attacker and I actually wanted to launch this attack, it's really quite easy. Now that I already have your attention and you're already coming to my typo website, I can divert your campaign contribution. What I can do, if you're coming to my domain, for example, barackobama.com with two A's, I can set up a website. It looks exactly like Barack Obama's website. you come to my website, you know, you see Barack Obama's website, you come to the donation page, and you click submit. Now, in this case, I don't actually have an SSL page unless I could get an SSL certificate for my type of domain, which may be possible. But in this case, it may not even be necessary because I already have you on my type of domain. So you click submit, you make a donation, and all I really have to do is make an HTTP post to John McCain's website. It's one page. It's very, very easy to do something like this. And today, campaigns really haven't done very much to protect themselves, you know, against this type of a simple attack. And the real reason for this is that, you know, they're trying to simplify the donation process. You know, we can see how much money is being raised online today from the public, many, many millions of dollars. And they've really tried to keep it simple, one page. There's no login that's required. There's really no registration. There's no CAPTCHA or human entry that's required. It's really as simple as it can get. But as a result, it introduces a number of problems. So one issue with that is obviously that if I'm an attacker and I realize that these websites are processing credit card transactions, I can go to their websites and I can start entering stolen credit card numbers. So we really call this a contribution denial of service. This is where a thief, for example, or an attacker targeting a particular campaign or a particular candidate can go to that candidate's website and really make a number of many small transactions to the website, attempting to confuse the actual campaign or try to at least dilute the contributions that are being received by the campaign. So we've seen this in the past, and we've seen it to some extent on charity websites in 2007, in which case charity websites were targeted by thieves. In this case, they were just trying to validate credit card numbers, though, simply because when I'm an attacker and I steal and compromise a stash of credit card numbers, and I compromise those from a, you know, a database online from a merchant, or I buy those credit card numbers from a thief, then I can go to a charity website and they'll tell me immediately whether or not that credit card number is legitimate and whether or not I can use it in the future. So we've seen that in the past in 2007, for example, where thieves were validating credit card numbers on charity websites. So it's certainly something that can be applied very, very easily to election websites as well. And it provides a way for attackers or thieves to disrupt the campaign. If you're seeing thousands of donations, it's really distracting to try to have to figure out which of those donations are actually fraudulent and which of them aren't, right? So it's a potentially effective way to distract a campaign from what they're really trying to do. Now, we've actually already seen this. We've seen it in a fairly limited basis. In 2007, for example, we saw the Ron Paul campaign become the victim of this type of an attack. In this case, thieves submitted roughly around 500 stolen credit card numbers to Ron Paul's website, and they made on average around donations in the ballpark of $5 to $10, so very, very small, which amounted to really only about $3,000 in losses. So it wasn't a lot, and it was relatively easy for attackers to, or for the campaign to actually filter this out and to refund the money back to the victims. But there's certainly ways that this can be made more effective through the use of botnets and other types of techniques. So phishing is, again, certainly something that has the potential to become more and more common, in particular when we look at how much money is actually at stake today throughout the course of an election. So another thing that we looked at is really the potential impact of malicious code on the election itself. So first of all, you know, one area we looked at is spyware. Spyware is something that, you know, we're all familiar with. In fact, there have been a number of organizations that have been collecting consumer information on the election and on elections for quite some time. The Gallup poll, for example, and the Gallup organization has been around since 1935, collecting information and collecting the disposition of voters, trying to determine which way voters are leaning. So the interesting thing, though, is that the Gallup organization allows you to voluntarily submit information. So it's something that you really need to volunteer to collect, you know, rather than something that can be collected surreptitiously. Spyware, on the other hand, really allows the widespread collection of information from the general population. It's something that can be used, for example, to collect information on what websites you're going to, which candidates you're trying to support, for example, which news feeds you're reading, which mailing lists you belong to, and really how many how many times you're visiting a particular candidate's website. So it really provides the ability to potentially track voters in a way that has really not been possible before. Now, the interesting thing is that many people still install spyware, and that's because, you know, in many cases, they voluntarily install spyware on their computer, and it's unclear to them what the applications are actually doing. In many cases, end-user license agreements are very, very long. In one case, when used, license agreement was over 45 pages, so it's very, very long and very, very convoluted, so it's difficult for consumers to really understand. Another really interesting way to track users online is through your web browser. And this is actually a little-known technique that is still in IE7. It's in every single web browser today that allows me, as a website owner, to actually see which websites you visited. And it's actually a factor of the way that style sheets work. And it's a somewhat little-known attribute within the style sheet that allows me to, for example, affect the way that a visited link is rendered when you visit a website. So, for example, when you visit a website, a link that you've visited in the past will show up in a different color. But the interesting thing here is that there's a style sheet attribute that allows me to configure or affect that particular link to be a different color. But what that style sheet attribute also lets me do is it actually lets me retrieve a URL. So what this means is that if, for example, I have a web page with hidden content in it that points to, let's say, a particular bank that I go to frequently, then that website that I visit will automatically be able to determine that I visited my bank's website through that hidden style sheet attribute. So just to give you an example of how this works, I've actually visited a sample website that's been set up by the University of Indiana and Professor Marcus Jacobson there, and this is really how it works. So this is a list of websites that I visited that he was able to determine that I visited through this hidden style sheet attribute. They're very, very simple. He was able to see on his website that I visited pretty much every single candidate's website. So this is relevant, again, not only to the election, but it's relevant for phishing in general. If I can determine which website you visited, I can seed you with the appropriate phishing website if I know which bank you regularly go to. Or in this case, I can seed you with the appropriate candidate's website if I'm launching a phishing attack. Or I can collect information. So if you can imagine this type of web page being on a very, very popular internet site, that site could tell which websites you visited, and it can tell which candidate's website you visited. So it's really an interesting way to collect information, but the surprising thing is that it's still something that's inherent in every browser today, and it's something that many people really don't know about. Okay, so another area is clearly malicious code. And when we look at malicious code and its potential to impact an election, there's really two primary ways. The first is that it can affect a widespread portion of the population in order to try to influence your vote or to track your movements on the internet as you're participating in the course of an election or as you're going to your favorite candidate's website. It can collect information from your computer. But the interesting thing really plays out when you look at the implications on a targeted attack on a particular candidate. So on a widespread basis, there's certainly a lot of things that malware can do. It can pop up advertisements. It can try to redirect your computer when you're trying to go to a particular candidate's website. But when you look at the implications in a targeted attack, they actually become far more concerning. So for example, campaign staff infected with a keylogger, or candidates infected with a keylogger, or with malicious code that, for example, turns on their microphone, or malicious code that infects the computer of the candidate's family. Right, so there's a variety of things that can potentially play into this when you consider that. Malware is very, very common today. It's very, very prevalent, and we see many, many targeted attacks already against corporations. So the potential for malicious code to steal, for example, speeches, sensitive information from a campaign system's computer is certainly a real problem. It's not something that we're aware of happening yet, but it certainly has the potential to play out in the future. Another thing that we see that we've seen a surge in is spyware for mobile phones. So FlexiSpy is a spyware application that you can buy. It infects or it can be installed on Symbian phones, on Windows mobile phones. It can be installed on really the top phone vendors today, and it allows you to record conversations. So if you can consider, for example, that a candidate's phone could be infected, or a member of a candidate's campaign or their family could potentially be infected with malicious code like this, you know, the potential leakage of information could certainly affect the outcome of the campaign. You know, we've seen examples of this in the past, which were actually, you know, purely accidental. In California, for example, Arnold Schwarzenegger's website had recordings of his internal meetings placed on the internet, and they were found and discovered by some of his competitors and exposed. So, you know, we see this type of information becoming leaking more and more regularly. So again, you know, it's really easy to say, well, you know, the impact of malicious code on a campaign isn't very significant, but let's consider what's at stake here when it is in fact, you know, the election of the next president. But again, we don't really want to blow this out of proportion. You know, these are all problems that we already see on a regular basis today. One thing that we've seen already is malicious code embedded in spam, election-based spam. We saw earlier this year, for example, malicious code that claimed to be coming from the Hillary Clinton campaign that linked you to a website that would infect you with malicious code. Where was this coming from? Not surprisingly, the Russian Business Network. Right, so these guys are behind a lot of the things that we see today. And this particular threat, when it infected you, installed a kernel mode rootkit, it hid all of its registry files, it hid all of the network connections, and it downloaded configuration files to turn your computer into a spam zombie. So they weren't really targeting the campaign. They're really just using the campaign to actually infect users and ultimately send more spam. So one thing that we see fairly regularly that we have seen in the past in the physical world is a variety of attacks that focus on deception, intimidation, and what we call cognitive attacks. So one of these types of attacks is really the distribution and the spread of misinformation. So when we look at the types of threats and the types of vehicles that we've talked about, and the, you know, the many ways that we can, for example, direct users to our own websites, there's a lot of different things that you can do, like the phishing sites that we showed and the typo-squatted sites. All three of these can be used fairly easily to spread misinformation. And when we look at misinformation, there's really a variety of things that we can talk about. Some of them could be fairly extreme, although they're not likely to really be believable if they're extreme. But they could be more subtle. So, for example, a candidate's decision to change their position on a given subject, like on a position that they have. Another thing that we can see coming to the internet that's used fairly heavily in the past in the physical world is push polling. Right. So an example of that is something that happened against the McCain campaign in the past, where voters were asked, you know, does the fact that John McCain have an illegitimate black child affect your decision or your position? You know, which is something that was very, very biased and very seated. But, you know, this is probably the best known example of push polling, you know, that exists, because that simply is not true in the first place, but it was stated as a fact as though it were true. So what really comes into play here is the security of campaign websites and how secure those sites are. One thing that we've seen already in many cases is we've seen cross-site scripting on existing candidate websites. We saw it on Mitt Romney's site at the end of January. We also saw it on Barack Obama's site in April. So these types of vulnerabilities are very, very common. Not surprising that we see them on candidate websites as well. The implication here is that if I'm an attacker, I can, for example, put an iframe on one of these candidates' websites that includes malicious code or that includes other information that I want to, I want to make it appear as though it came from Barack Obama's website. So again, very, very common. Campaigns are starting to figure this out. The Barack Obama campaign, for example, had an ad up soliciting for someone to help them with their network security. Now, deception and intimidation is, again, something we've seen very, very frequently in the physical world. We saw it in the 2006 election, whereby around 14,000 voters, Latino voters in Orange County, were targeted by a mail campaign, and they were really threatened. If these were legitimate, legal immigrants in the U.S., and they were sent letters telling them that if they participated in the election, that they would be incarcerated and potentially deported out of the country. Right. So these types of events are very common, and they happen pretty frequently. So it's surprising to see that these things are happening. We saw it again in 2004 in Pittsburgh, where college students were targeted by people on the street, petitioners, asking them to sign petitions for medical marijuana, asking them to sign petitions for auto insurance rates. But the actual thing that they were signing, they were actually changing their party affiliation, and that also resulted in them changing their polling station and their polling location. So there's an act actually that's being reviewed by the Senate right now called the Deceptive Practices and Voter Intimidation Prevention Act of 2007. And this will make these types of attacks largely illegal. It's actually surprising to me that they're not illegal already. But we still see that policy and the passing of these types of laws really hasn't been that effective. We've seen it in the past with spam, for example. The CAN Spam Act and other acts have been largely ineffective. 80% of the email on the internet today is still spam. We don't see it, but it's being filtered out, but there's still a lot of spam. It's still incurring a lot of cost. So we can really see that these laws are good if you can actually catch the perpetrator, but in many cases, they're just not very effective. And these types of scams and the widespread use of email to influence people have been used very, very heavily by fraudsters, guys who are trying to launch pump and dump scams by increasing the price of penny stocks and then profiting from them. Right, so these types of mass mailing campaigns are very, very common. We have seen spam already throughout the course of this election. We saw around 120,000 messages targeting the Ron Paul campaign. And this again is something that's increasingly common, as spammers are also clearly very biased when it comes to who they're likely to vote for. Okay, so one thing, we've talked about typo squatting, we've talked about phishing, we've talked about malicious code. So really, we wanted to look at a variety of things, not only the traditional types of threats that we see. One thing we looked at was the Federal Election Commission. And the interesting thing about the Federal Election Commission is that they collect a lot of information on donors and who's actually making contributions to these campaigns. The FEC was created in 1975, and it was created essentially to monitor the donation process and the donations being made and collected by campaigns. Now, the FEC has to maintain and provide a public record of all donations over $200. So this is something that they track. Every donation over $200 has to be recorded by the campaign and ultimately make its way over to the FEC and add it to their database. Now, the great thing about the FEC is that all of this data is public. You can go to their FTP server, and you can find all of the data that they've collected, and you can mine it. So what can you do with this? Well, it's actually quite interesting. You can look for people that you know. You can look for really anyone in a particular zip code. You can look for people in a certain city. You could, for example, look in high net worth areas and identify people that you want to target with a more sophisticated attack or with a phishing campaign, right? So there's a variety of things that you can really do in order to collect information. So, you know, I wanted to show an example here. And in this case, Dave Itell was kind enough to let me use him. And, you know, I was able to find really, really easily just by entering his name into the New York Times search site, which uses the FEC data. And I was able to see that he made a donation of $1,500 to Barack Obama. Right? So this information is readily available. You know, it's interesting. It allows you to find people who've donated money and potentially target them for future attacks. And campaigns, obviously, are doing a lot of data mining. They're collecting a ton of information today, and they're likely applying some fairly sophisticated algorithms to mine all of this data, looking for any way that they can get an advantage. Okay, so and we talked about a variety of attacks, but when we really think about, you know, who is likely to participate in these attacks, we really think that the campaigns themselves are not likely to participate in some of the more extreme attacks that we talked about. It's very unlikely that Barack Obama's campaign is going to write malware that targets McCain's campaign. You know, they may buy advertising, right, with the keywords for McCain, although we haven't necessarily seen that. So the campaigns are not likely to participate in some of the more extreme attacks. They may participate in some of the more gray attacks that we saw, but again, we haven't really seen a lot of this, and that may be because the campaigns simply aren't familiar with some of these, the potential of these attacks, or they're just staying away because they want to run a clean campaign. So more than likely, the people who are actually going to do a lot of this are the extremists, or those who are in it for profit. So people who are on the extreme side, who feel very, very strongly about a candidate, or the guys who are trying to really profit from these types of attacks. Now, the unfortunate side effect of a lot of this is that, you know, these types of attacks have the potential to really decrease confidence in online donations. They have the potential to decrease confidence in the electoral system in general. So they're somewhat psychological in that, you know, if you're infected with malware targeting a particular candidate, well, it clearly affects your perception on the election in general. So again, it's still fairly early on because we haven't seen a lot of these attacks, but you can guarantee that more and more of these types of things will become more common in future elections as the internet and as computers play more of a central role, in particular on raising money online. So campaigns need to really become more aware of these types of attacks. I think they've done a good job recently because in many cases, the campaigns that have been targeted, for example, with cross-site scripting vulnerabilities have done a really good job at this, of protecting themselves. But it's still a complex problem. And when we look at all of the potential attacks, there's really a lot of them, and it's very difficult for campaigns to really consider them all. So with that being said, thank you very much, and happy to answer any questions. Oh, thank you.